Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. The inner game is the relationship we have to our authentic purpose and contribution in life. It's about the ways that we grow personally and spiritually on the inside that affects everything on the outside of our lives. The quality of our inner game is becoming increasingly important because we now know that the world shifts to reflect whatever is inside us. Each of our contributions is critical to the quality of what is possible for us all on the planet. These are conversations with people who are up to something evolutionary in their lives, and an opportunity to hear about how these people take on their spiritual and personal growth and how that strengthens their organizations and businesses and projects to make a bigger difference. Our guest today is Ellen Pevick, PhD, who initiated her first award-winning school gardening program in 1998 at an elementary school in Vancouver, Canada. Since then, she has gained national and international recognition for her work in the U.S., Canada, and Brazil, reconnecting children to nature. She's the author of Growing a Life. I'm so grateful to get to have this conversation with you, Ellen.
Thank you, Gwen. I'm very happy to be here with you.
So I just want to give people a little bit of context for your incredible journey in life. Your mom was really your spiritual guide, and she started a very beautiful spiritual path when you were 11. What were your first kind of experiences or insights that you remember from that time?
Well, as an 11-year-old, I just thought it was odd.
Of course.
But my parents had, besides my mother's own spiritual practice of Subud, my parents also together were part of a religious discussion group that was five couples from their church and the Episcopal Church in Denver, that where they every month got together to discuss the teachings of different religions in the world. So I grew up hearing respect for all different religions and spiritual paths. And I feel that's been really fundamental to me in my understanding and my own spiritual growth of seeing the value of many, many paths.
Right. So you decided that this was a path for you at 21. What was the awareness there that made you so sure that, okay, this is for me?
Well, I was at Stanford University in the middle of the Vietnam War, very engaged in all of the protests that were going on to stop the war. I spoke publicly at high schools to encourage students to apply to be COs or resist the draft because I felt the United States was fighting a war that was causing nothing but harm for everyone, our country and Vietnam. And I realized in the peace movement that things were not going to change fundamentally the way they had to for there really to be peace until people changed inside themselves. And Stanford was very engaged in doing military research, CIA research, and I began to feel I couldn't be there because it felt immoral to me to use knowledge to harm other people. And so I left at the beginning of my senior year. I was aware that trying to solve the huge political, economic conflicts of this world just with one's intellect and one's body on the line was not going to solve anything, that there had to be interchange. And I came home from working a semester at a high school in Redwood City where I was teaching assistant for kids that were refugees from all of the revolutions that were going on in Central America, revolutions that the CIA was involved in, every single one. I was seeing this incredible human impact of the American political process around the world. And I knew I had to step back. I had to find some inner growth in myself to know how to live in the world. And I got home and I realized that I really wanted to investigate my mother's spiritual path and see if it was appropriate for me. And so that's what I decided to do.
What was it about that path that resonated with you?
Well, at that time, I didn't really know anything about it, but I think the fact that it had people of all religions in it, that it wasn't a lot of teachings, because my mind wanted a rest, that it was an inner experience, was what mattered to me. And that's what I found. I waited a few months before I started doing it myself, and I had very profound experiences from the very beginning of coming into Subud. And I started working with little children because they gave me a lot of joy. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that was a big turning point in my life. I had a little preschool here in Carbondale that I actually operated part of the time out of the Smithy, and in the summers, before it was the Smithy, that's that building, and in the summers I had it totally out of doors, a family that owned land that is on the side of the Crystal River. They had 40 acres there, and they gave me the 40 acres two summers in a row to just have a big tent out there and have children and doing all outdoor nature activities. So that was the start of me doing nature education with little kids, which was really just playing outside all the time.
And that's something that has continued on throughout your entire career.
Yes.
What do you think it is about working with children for you that feels, that calls to you so much?
Because they're so curious and they're so totally engaged in what they do, and it's just enchanting to watch them develop. And it's really about creating the proper environment in which children can find themselves. And nature is, we are part of nature, and nature is that. And I had that as a little child growing up in Aspen in my early childhood when there were only 800 people and nature was everywhere around us. So that's what I was doing with these kids, giving them what I had had, because I felt it's where you're happy when you're little.
So you're exploring spirituality, your own, and always, I'm sure, the wisdom traditions throughout the world. And you start your own family and have five children and decide to finish your undergrad degree at 42. And all this time you are doing projects and educational explorations with children in different kinds of venues. And you get a PhD at 50.
No, I didn't get a PhD at 50. I started my master's when I turned 50.
Okay, so you go back to graduate school at 50.
I went to graduate school at 50,
okay.
Right. And that's when I decided, again, because of seeing injustice in the public school system, seeing that rich schools had more resources for their students than poor schools did, primarily because the parents at rich schools are connected in the business world, and they know how to write grants. They can bring things in from their business connections, and people in poor schools don't have those connections and don't know how to write grants. And I just felt it was totally unfair to poor kids. So I started working and developing school gardens because of that, and doing it at a very poor inner city school in Vancouver.
And then decided that a PhD was necessary at that stage in the game in your life for what?
Well, I came back to Colorado after I did this garden and after I had worked in Brazil, which is what I had always wanted to do since I was 15, was go back to where I was born and work with poor children. So I was able to do that because I got a grant from the Canadian government. And there were actually Subud members in southern Brazil who had a private school and wanted to do some outreach to the poor favela that was very near their school. Because since they had a private school, it was parents that could pay for school that came to that sent their children to their school. And they wanted to do something for the kids in the favela. So I wrote them and I said, you know, can I come work with you? I'd like to do an outreach program to those kids too. And I got a grant from the Canadian government to do it. So I did that. And then I ended up coming back to Colorado because my own parents were in their late 80s living up on a mountainside up the Crystal River, and they needed help. And a year away from doing all of this work, or 2 years, I realized I had to get back into it, that this was really my calling. And I applied to a PhD program at CU because it was called Children, Youth, and Environment. So it was absolutely the perfect setting for me, and it was completely interdisciplinary. And I was able to shape my own course of study entirely. And so that brought me into working actually here, starting the high school garden here. I got a lot of grants from CU Outreach to help with educational materials and field trips for the kids at Roaring Fork High School and at Yampa, who had also just started their domes. And I started working with Fat City Farmers, persuaded them to work with the schools. It all wove together, and it all came from my own inner understanding of what I needed to be doing in the world.
And how do you articulate that? How did you then, and is it similar now?
I feel it inside myself, and so I do the work that I'm moved to do. So my work is to create these opportunities of creating educational environments where kids can be outside connecting with the natural world and connecting with healthy food, because we have such a serious health crisis in this country that has really been caused by the industrialization of food, by the introduction to public schools of pop machines, which are now illegal. There had to be a legal fight to get them out, but they were there for 20 years. And in very insidious ways, corporate America has destroyed the food system, and they advertise horrible food to kids. Nobody is advertising carrots to kids because the carrot industry doesn't have that kind of money. It's the soft drink industry, the candy industry, the McDonald's, I won't even say the rest of their names, all of those fast food purveyors that have enormous advertising budgets, and they target kids, and it is destroying people's health.
Let's take a quick break and say this is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KDNK. My guest today is Ellen Pevick, and we're talking about the expression of her spiritual growth in the work that she is doing and has done for many years around the world. I wonder what the values are that you hold most dearly about honoring children and their own development as human beings. What are some of the things that are just incredibly important to you to have expressed in the educational programs that you've been a part of?
I have been attracted to working with children who don't have equal opportunity to good education, because I feel like all human beings truly are equal. We are all the children of God. There is no one who is lesser or greater than another. But the economic and social situations into which individuals are born have an enormous impact on what opportunities are available to them. So I feel like it is important, because that has been so clear to me since I first saw it in my own home country of Brazil as a 15-year-old, and I saw the disparity between rich and poor that was just a slap in the face because the contrast was so enormous, that it is my job on earth to try to create more equal access to healthy life learning situations for kids of all ages, from preschool to college. And I've worked with all ages of kids and tried to focus on creating healthier learning environments, environments where kids are active, where they're engaging with what they're doing, where they're engaging in nature. They are learning how the life cycles work. They see it. You don't have to talk to them about it. And when you're doing that kind of work with children, when you're outside planting a vegetable garden or harvesting a vegetable garden, the conversations you have are wonderful and natural. There's not as much a division between grown-ups and kids, because everybody's just as amazed to see a seed sprout as anybody else. Doesn't matter how old you are. Everybody's amazed at what a carrot tastes like when you pull it straight out of the ground and just dust a little bit of dirt off and pop it in your mouth. So it brings an equality to everybody. And you see it amongst the high school students, where there's some social divisions in some classes. In the gardening, in the agricultural biology class that Hadley runs here at Roaring Fork High School, there's huge bridges crossed because everybody's working together. And it brings people together, as well as bringing people in touch with nature.
You've gotten to witness firsthand these amazing disparities in financial wealth in communities.
Yes.
And it's interesting to me that you've always been drawn to this valley, where that disparity is so very extreme and surreal, as well as, I'm sure, places in Brazil that you witnessed. What do you feel like that does to us as human beings?
I think it makes some people feel like they must be worthier than other people, because there is not enough done systemically to address these issues. Mm-hmm. And it's getting, as we all know, it's getting much worse in the United States than it was when I was a child. One place that I went to interview kids for my book was the Bronx, the South Bronx, and another place was East Oakland. Those are cities next to, well, the South Bronx is right next to Manhattan, right? And I worked, I did interviews with kids who are part of the Green Bronx machine, where they come from unbelievably violent and poor backgrounds. Some of these kids have witnessed someone standing next to them be shot. When I was in Oakland, there was a shooting of a 12-year-old in a drive-by that caused a lockdown in a school where the shooting didn't happen in the school. It happened at his house, but the school was locked down while I was there interviewing kids. And these gardening programs literally are saving kids' lives mm-hmm. in the inner city because it gives them a safe place to go to engage in something that makes them feel good about themselves. It keeps them off the streets, which are dangerous, and it gives them people to relate to that are not in gangs. So these programs in our inner cities of the United States of America are saving children's lives.
It feels like the self-esteem piece is very central. What is it you think about developing a relationship with the natural world that bolsters our self-esteem as human beings?
You're taking care of life. A child or a teenager who is engaged in nurturing life, which is what you're doing when you plant a seed, when you mulch, when you water, you're nurturing life, and they feel that, and they talk about it. They can express that. They express it to me very clearly.
And is there a piece of also feeling empowered that's a big part of this?
Yes, I heard a little boy from Denver who was about 10 at a Bioneers conference when people were asking him about his experience as a gardener. Say, I make life happen. I thought, what is more empowering than that? And they're working as a team. They all care about each other because they're doing this together. They know that the adults who are supporting them and being essentially facilitators and guides, more than teachers, love them because that's the environment that is created when you're nurturing life together.
When you said, you know, I make life happen and how powerful that is, I flashed on something I've often thought about young women and girls and the insanely large amount of children that disempowered and abused girls often have in different parts of the world and our country as well. And that powerful piece of when everything else is taken away from you, you still can create life. What if that piece of, you know, having too many children and how damaging that can be for a lot of young women, what if that were channeled into gardening and being caretakers of the land? And I'm wondering if what you've seen along those lines.
Well, I just finished working on a project that I've been involved with for the last 2 years in Peru. That it was a health project to see if we could improve the outcomes of babies from birth to age 3. And so we were engaged in a multi-pronged educational effort to teach home gardening for having home kitchen gardens, nutrition and cooking, and parenting skills. And we ended up training 15 women from these 11 communities that are all refugees from the political turmoil that Peru experienced for many years when the Shining Path was active. And they moved to the hillsides that are along the coast of Peru that are totally desolate, barren, sharp. They don't even have soil. They're just rocks. And we trained these women to be health educators in their own community, and it transformed their lives. They were people without any formal education, and they became resources to their community, teaching people how to plant seeds, how to use organic fertilizer, how to cook, how to treat their children kindly, with compassion, and to have conversations rather than to give orders. And I watched people transformed in a year, totally transformed in their self awareness and their confidence, their esteem, their ability to work in the world. It was a phenomenal thing to witness.
What a gift to get to witness offering to people. How has that changed you?
Oh, well, I want to do more of it. I want to work with, we want to keep working with these women because they've really formed such a fabulous team. We feel like there's so much more they could do because there's so many more babies to reach in the community, so many more families. And I'd love to keep that model going.
Is it a program that could be, do you think, pretty easily replicated other places?
It could be. The idea of starting all over again is a little bit daunting. We'd rather keep working with the same team we've developed right now, and we have to wait and see what our health outcomes are. They still haven't all been analyzed. It's all medical tests that have been done on the kids and developmental tests, and not all the data has been analyzed yet. We're waiting to see.
Ellen, what are some of the practices that you have that you've just, you know, kind of are part of your life now that you feel like support you the most in acting with the consciousness that you really want to expand in the world?
Well, my spiritual practice that's called Subud is something that has been a part of my life for 49 years now that I have never stopped. It's a receiving, a surrendering. It's not a teaching. And in that period of complete surrender, when I'm doing the practice, I am nurtured inwardly. I am given insight about myself and my relationship to the world. And I follow that. So that is the most consistent thing that has been guiding me all of these years in what I do.
What is it that allows you to surrender? Because that's something we've talked about that many of us have a very hard time with. We think we need to have all the answers. We think we need to be in control. We need to be smart, be, you know, an agent of change. And surrender feels somehow scary.
Well, it's a surrender to God, not a surrender to somebody else. So it's not believing that someone else has an answer. And it's a gift. It's a grace that comes, this ability to surrender. And it's given. And it is only to God, not to anything else.
And what about so many of us that may have a hard time with the concept of God and like, I'm not going to surrender to some, I don't even know what, you know, that I'm not sure I even believe in? Or like, what's the surrender to that makes it easier for you?
Well, because the experience in this spiritual practice is actually begins as a vibration in your body. It makes you realize this is something beyond you. It's not something you're making happen. When you realize that this is not something you're controlling and that it'll stop if you try to control it, then you realize that, and it makes you feel great, that then you can surrender to that. It is, there's no intellectual part of it
right.
at all. So
yeah.
there's no thinking about it. If
yeah.
you think about it, it stops.
Right.
So.
It's so funny, that old saying, you know, if you're talking about Zen, it's not Zen.
Yes. There you go.
Do you feel like the underpinnings or the, you know, what's called the unified field, the all of everything, is this beneficent kind of beautiful force that's there for us to just trust and align with so that we can be our biggest contribution?
The creation has come out of love, and it is there for all beings. And I think it's part of why gardens are such a wonderful way to connect with children and grown-ups of all ages, is that we relax in gardens and we get back in touch with the rest of creation. We don't have to be thinking about any ism, because the force of nature is also vibrating with the same, we're all vibrations, you know? Physicists know that. And people on spiritual paths know that. We are all, I mean, the whole universe is vibrating. And it's a creative vibrating force. And it is about life. And it's in everything and in everybody. And in a garden, people can feel that together. Mm. So I think that's probably part of what has drawn me to working in gardens with kids is that it is a place where they can be in touch with themselves on a deeper level than other places.
There
perhaps.
Are so many awarenesses available there. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a beautiful place to wrap up. Thank you all for listening today. We're going to be doing a part two of this because there are so many lessons in all of the projects that Alen has been a part of throughout her life. How old are you now, Alen?
I'm 70.
That's amazing.
Seven decades.
You know, that you are still just as creative, if not more, than ever in your life. And that's inspiring. And if you have a question for Alen or me, please join the Facebook page at The Inner Game. The page acts as a forum to continue these conversations. And until next time, boy, get out in a garden. Get out with something alive that's growing just for your own delight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sweet.